Hello and welcome to Faithfully Memphis. This is Reverend Paul McLean, Associate Rector of Calvary Episcopal Church, located in the heart of downtown Memphis, one of the oldest parishes in the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee. Every Thursday morning at 8, we have the opportunity to speak with interesting people and to learn about the role that faith plays in their lives. We are broadcasting from WYXR 91.7 FM in Memphis, Tennessee. Today I'm joined by Sam O'Brien, Executive Director of Literacy Mid-South, and we will talk about the innovative new partnership between Literacy Mid-South and the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee to improve third grade reading levels in the most vulnerable communities in our region. Often, the liturgical calendar of the church seems to dovetail the events happening around us, but sometimes the contrast of the feast and seasonal days in our calendars and what's actually occurring in our world can jar and unnerve us, and that's what's happening this week. Today is Ascension Day, a day when we celebrate Jesus triumphantly ascending into heaven to rejoin his Father after conquering death through his resurrection. But Tuesday, just 2 days ago, could be called Descension Day, when 19 children and two teachers were senselessly killed in Uvalde, Texas. We are all still reeling, and it's hard for us to picture any type of ascension in the midst of utter sadness and horror. We are left wondering, has Jesus ascended and abandoned us? Far from it. Jesus' ascension gives him a bird's eye view to see the whole world, especially to see its suffering and its sorrow. From his perch, he cannot help but weep. The theologian N.T. Wright puts it this way, Jesus has gone ahead of us into God's space, God's new world, and is both already ruling the present world as its rightful Lord and also interceding for us at the Father's right hand. Only when we grasp and celebrate what the Ascension tells us about the continuing human work of Jesus in the present are we equipped for the task of justice. I must confess that my first draft of this reflection was titled 21 Angels. Last evening, a parishioner reminded me that a 22nd person died in the shooting, the gunman himself. I must admit it is hard for me to see him as an angel right now. But if I can ascend just enough to see him through the eyes of God, I get closer to the words from the Prayer for Our Enemies in the Book of Common Prayer. Lead them and us from prejudice to truth. Deliver them and us from hatred, cruelty, and revenge. And in your good time, enable us all to stand reconciled before you. Jesus is now joined by these new angels. Their innocence, their hopes, their love lives on forever. They join him in lifting us all up beyond a cruel world of horrific assault weapons and hate, and enable us to imagine a world filled with peace and building one another up. A world overflowing with deep care for the fragile lives of everyone around us. In that spirit, St. Mary's Episcopal Cathedral at 700 Poplar will be open from 11 to 1:30 both today, Thursday, May 26, and tomorrow, Friday, May 27, for a time of prayer, and all are welcome. It will be a great time to reflect on our task, which is to join Jesus and these precious new angels and lifting our world up to be a place where children and teachers are safe, where love triumphs over hate, where heaven and earth are at long last one. Fly, angels, fly. It is a joy to have Sam O'Brien of Literacy Mid-South here. Sam, first of all, my heart goes out to you as the child of educators, as someone who's worked around education all his life, and as a parent of three children, two of them very young children, in view of the tragic shooting at the school in Uvalde this week. How are you doing in the midst of this event on this already difficult week for you when you've been recovering from COVID?
Oh, wow. Well, thanks, Paul. Well, thanks for having me. Thanks for the invite. Thrilled to share a lot of things here. And please excuse if I have to clear my throat or cough every once in a while, because that also goes back to the recovery. But when I think about, coming out of COVID isolation and then coming into this week, kind of trying to get back into the swing of things, and something like this happens. I was at work when it came across the news ticker, and you go to the different news outlets and everyone is reporting, very sadly, updated numbers of how many people have died. I think a couple of the first numbers were like 2 to maybe 4 people had been killed. And then by the end of the day, I think 14 was the number that it kind of floated around. And then the next day, I think we got to where, 22 people, as you said, total, had been killed. And for me, that same day that happened was also the last day of school for my children. Mm-hmm. And, so I start to think about that. It was I think about, of course, my youngest is 7. And, all these thoughts kind of go in your head. You start thinking about, why does something like this happen? Is my child's school secure enough to where this could be prevented? You start to kind of internalize these things. And the following day, of course, that was the last day of school. The following day, I took a mental health day. Mm-hmm. And because, a few weeks before this, we had the tragic shooting in Buffalo, New York. Mm-hmm. And all these things tend to run together, at some point, or at least they're reported close together. and so, just thinking about that, took a mental health day, and, I just kept the kids at home with me. We hung out and went a couple of places, and it was really just, I think, my way of just kind of keeping them close to me, because, through the school year, they're in school all day. Right. I'm at work. We get home and, we get busy with homework and all these other things that kind of just, they compete for your time. But this was a full day where there was no homework. I could take, a mental health day, a PTO day, and we could do the things we wanted to do. And, that day, we went shopping for like college t-shirts, mm-hmm. I took them to a store that had these different colleges. I said, just pick. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see what they picked. Sure. Two of my kids picked my alma mater, Alcorn State. The third kid.
Go Braves.
Yes. The third kid picked a different school. So, I'm having a conversation with him about that, mm-hmm. About you're testing the limits of my mercy. but, it was those sorts of things, just kind of making sure that I was present in the moment, in the middle of what had just happened. And, and even that was tough because, again, the week prior, I was isolated, with COVID. So I'm over in the guest room, mm-hmm. just away from everybody. All I got is like my phone and my computer, and I'm texting, my children in my own home, mm-hmm. So to kind of come out of that isolation and then be met with something like this, the immediate thing was to let me just hang out with them. Let me just take this time and let's just see where the day goes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's wonderful that you took that day to be with your kids, and that was your first impulse. That's where you wanted to be. And and you reminded me too that this season, again, talked about something incongruent. It's a time of celebration in the education community. It's a graduation time, and parishioners here at Calvary have been posting graduation photos ranging from kindergarten to college graduations, and how families are so proud and happy. And then right in the midst of this happens, and it just is unnerving.
I even think, some reports were saying that school actually had their awards day.
Wow.
So there were children that received, awards for, AB honor roll, principal's list, or whatever, whatever those categories are. Mm-hmm. And again, they were looking forward to a summer. They were looking forward to, we're going to a water park, or we're going to hang out in the backyard, just mm-hmm. looking forward to summer. And then we kind of talk about, again, we were saying like how finality kind of has these different takes.
Yeah.
And, again, wrapping your mind around all of that. You know, these are children that will they wanted to grow up to be something, and now they'll never get to be that.
Yeah.
And so, no, my heart and whatnot goes out to their families, of course. You know, I also think that right now in this time it's real easy to get into debates around, you know, thoughts and prayers, and then leading to policy and change, and you know, and those discussions are going to happen, and we'll see what route they take, you know.
Yeah.
Because again, this reminds us of how often this is reported, how often this happens,
yeah,
and how we always come back to those conversations. So,
yeah.
But I think, you know, to me, it's important to understand that those were someone's babies.
Yeah.
And we definitely have to find ways to support those individuals that have lost so much.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I did want to let you know, too, Canon Sharon Alexander of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee shared with a lot of the clergy that the Episcopal Diocese of West Texas is putting together a fund, I think, to help victims' families, to help that general area, too. And so there are ways to, you know, for tangible ways for us to support some of the efforts to lift these folks, lift these families up.
That's great. That's great.
Yeah. But Sam, tell us about your journey as the child of educators in Greenwood, Mississippi, in the heart of the Delta.
Yes.
And how your passion for education and literacy was stoked within you. You said every time you try to move away from education, you get pulled back in.
I get pulled back. So this is always a weird story. I say weird, but it lets you know how much of a nerd that I really was when I was growing up, right?
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger, my heroes were always always politicians,
mm-hmm,
right? And I think this is going back to I was in the fourth grade and I ran for class president, and it was just this powerful feeling. It's like I'm class president, you know. I'm thinking I can just talk to the teacher and I can recommend what we need to be learning and things like that. But I was really like a overglorified hall monitor, you know, but still, it's like we had this election process, you know. We had to like do campaign signs and, you know, court classmates for votes, and then there was a vote at the end of the day, and you know, I won.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it, you know. And at the same time, a gentleman that I really looked up to, a guy by the name of Mike Espy, and Mike Espy was the first African-American congressman elected to Congress from Mississippi since Reconstruction, you know. So we're talking about Reconstruction is, you know, 1860, late 1860s, 1870s,
exactly.
And Mike Espy was elected in like 1985 or 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, Mike Espy was the same energy that we had around Barack Obama in 2008. Mississippi Delta had that energy around Mike Espy in 1985, mm-hmm, right? And so I'm thinking, like, I want to be like this guy. I want to run for Congress. I don't know what Congress is, but I want to be a politician. Mike Espy is just so cool, and you know, and so, and I say all that because so here I am, fourth grade, and my goal was to be a congressman,
mm-hmm,
right? And that really informed just the way that I did school. And it was, I think it was fortified because, you know, we talk about my parents being teachers.
Mm-hmm.
My mom taught social studies and history.
Mm-hmm.
So I really gravitated to the things that my mom taught.
Mm-hmm.
My dad taught math at different levels, whether it's pre-algebra, algebra 2, geometry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they both were close to 30-year educators. So, again, current events, education, literacy, those things were just always in our home,
mm-hmm,
you know, due to the nature of just the work that my parents did. I would say that really stoked just this passion for like understanding education and seeing how education could be a vehicle to do the things that I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I always go back to looking at, you know, my parents' upbringing, right? Mm-hmm. And so this goes back to, again, just what Greenwood was for my parents. For 3 years, they've lived in Greenwood pretty much most of their lives,
mm-hmm,
from childhood to even now. And they saw Greenwood a little bit differently. They saw, you know, their parents were sharecroppers.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad and my mom spent time, you know, sharecropping in their youth.
Mm-hmm.
And so education for them allowed them, in their words, to get out of the cotton fields. You know, but there were certain things even centered around education that helped that out. You know, you had the Higher Education Act of 1965 that really opened up higher education for like everybody. Mm-hmm. So my parents came up through that time. So this is this combination of, again, you know, public policy, you know, grit, determination, educational drive, really creating opportunities. So so when I think about growing up in Greenwood, all of that permitted an existence that was different from a lot of what was going on in the region. I would call a solid middle class sort of existence in an area that is, you know, traditionally, historically, multi-generationally dealing with poverty and racism. Mm-hmm. So I got a chance to kind of live a little bit differently, but I didn't fully understand it. I was just, again, just living, again, just a little bit differently. But I understood, again, this is how education makes a life better. This is how public policy makes a life better. So how can I participate in this and make a life better for myself or for those that are, you know, connected to me? The literacy angle is, my mom was also a certified reading instructor, in addition to being a middle school history teacher. Mm-hmm. So one thing that she just, you know, dead set was just strict about was, before you get into a kindergarten classroom, you're going to read. Because my mom understood that this is kind of where this foundational learning is. This is where, you know, students are kind of grouped by ability. And so it was her job. She just said, you're going to be able to read before you get into a kindergarten classroom. And I was able to. And being able to read before I get into that classroom really opened up and set that foundation for being an honor student, set that foundation for just, you know, learning and comprehending and being able to do the work. And that laid a foundation, you know, that I think that served me well for a long time. And so all of those things, you know, you don't realize in the moment that they're imprinting on you until you get older. Yeah. And so, you know, I would say coming out of Greenwood, you know, I graduated from Amanda Elsey High School, and the job, I mean, that's not the job, the college I chose, again, chose Alcorn State. And going back to the Mike Espy story, I decided to major in plant and soil science when I went to Alcorn State, because Mike Espy had by then had become the Secretary of Agriculture in the first administration under Bill Clinton.
Right.
So I'm thinking, I still want to be Mike Espy. So what do I need to do to be Mike Espy? And, you know, like he was a commissioner of Secretary of Agriculture.
Right.
Let me major in, you know, agriculture. Let me do plant and soil science. And I went to Alcorn, full scholarship, plant and soil science, and I hated every single minute of it. It was not for me.
Yeah.
I was working outside a lot. And of course the heat in Mississippi is unrelenting and unforgiving. I worked, if I was inside, I was inside a greenhouse. So it was really not much different.
Right.
And I did not like it at all. But by the time I figured out that this is not what I wanted to do as a career, you know, I had taken all the classes. Taken all the major classes, taken all the prerequisites. I was going to graduate with that degree, but I wanted to do something different. And an advisor of mine said, "Why don't you, you know, you like politics, you're in student government, you know, why don't you major in public administration?" And I was like, "Oh, okay." And I didn't really give it a whole lot of thought. Like,
right.
My advisor said public administration sounds like politics, you know, cool. And that's kind of where I kind of wanted to definitely work in the public sector and do some community-based things. But again, I was not thinking education. But everything that I did, you know, after obtaining that degree was either centered around community-based work, working with children, or in partnership with schools. And so that goes back to the point, like I could never get away from doing work that impacted children or doing work that was in partnership with schools. And so I was like, let me just live in it and see where it takes me.
Sure.
And it took me from, you know, from Alcorn to, I worked in Little Rock for a little bit. I started working with Pulaski County Youth Services, after school programs, out of school summertime programs, you know, things for ACT prep, summer internships, building those programs from the ground up, just seeing what youth development looks like. From there, still worked in the community service space around just, you know, economic development work, still, again, that community-based impact work, and then worked at the Clinton School for about a year, a little bit over a year and a half. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did fulfill one goal of sort. You know, I did not become Secretary of Agriculture, but I did work for a president, mm-hmm. even though it was his post-presidential legacy. So exactly. I still count that. Like, there, so that's go. Something that Mike Espy and I do have in common. That's, we worked, exactly. you know, under the Clinton name.
That's right.
So right. I count that as a victory. Yeah. Was in Little Rock for about 8 years, mm-hmm. and moved to Memphis. I want to say it was 2012. Mm-hmm. And when I arrived here, started working with School Seed Foundation, and that work really got me a lot closer to education than I'd ever been. Mm-hmm. As a School Seed functioned as a public engagement, community engagement intermediary, mm-hmm. with then Shelby County Schools, now Memphis Shelby County Schools, and it was there where I really started to see how education works, like right. how people lead in a public education space, how policy is kind of passed down, mm-hmm. how there are mandates that may come from, you know, the Department of Ed, the State Department of Ed, that says this is how we should teach, mm-hmm. How ed reform in many ways lives in a city like Memphis and influences the way that education works. Mm-hmm. Worked there for close to 9 years, just, you know, mainly in the community partnership space, but there was just a lot of work that I was able to be a part of because we were so close to the district. So there was, you know, work in the as an academic thought partner that we were able to be a part of as related to Black male achievement, race mm-hmm. and equity work, and how those things kind of manifest themselves in academic achievement. And, you know, it was really good work. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I would say that then brought me here. So I've been with Literacy Mid-South a little bit over 9 months. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, being in Memphis for close to 10 years, still having this understanding of the landscape.
Right.
And the work that we do at Literacy Mid-South, you know, is focused on literacy across the lifespan, you know, ranging with programs where we work with, you know, the earliest of parents. We work with expectant mothers all the way up to grandparents who wish to reach their grandchildren. So we do have programs all the way across the that life spectrum. But, you know, we do this in a way where we define literacy as it's more than just picking up a text, picking up a book, and being able to read the words. While that is, you know, a great thing and we want that, when we talk about literacy in the context of Memphis, it has to fit in a way that moves Memphis forward.
Yes.
And so for us, literacy is the skills the dispositions to redress and correct those things that prevent us from having our greatest opportunities. So when we talk about 100% literacy for the Mid-South, yes, we want every person to be able to read a book, you know, at a level that is proficient. But we also want everybody to have the skills and the dispositions to redress and correct these things that prevent us from getting to our greatest opportunity.
It's
not like that's my life in a nutshell, but that's my life in a nutshell.
Sure.
But it, going back to my parents, you know, growing up in Greenwood, Mississippi, and kind of throwing this all the way back, my parents grew up, you know, in the immediate post Jim Crow South. Mm-hmm. So literacy, what to them was that? It was acquiring those skills to correct and redress, you know, things that prevented opportunity. My parents grew up in the same time, you know, they were young children, I think 10 or 11 years old, around the time that Emmett Till was brutally murdered, you know, yeah. And, you know, things like that leave an impression on people. And then as a result, I think those things are passed down, you know, generationally as, you know, cautionary tales, as warnings. And as this is, even though this is probably the worst of it, you know, this is something that pushes us to be better. Like, how do we prevent something like this going forward, even though these things evolve in different ways? How do we prevent something like this going forward? And I think that was something that my parents thought through, you know, understanding that, you know, seeing Little Rock Nine on TV or sure. hearing about it on the radio or even being alive when, you know, when Dr. King was murdered. All these things informed my parents. And then they're, again, they're imprinted on, you know, myself and my brothers as we go through this education journey. So it's not just education for the sake of learning, education for the sake of gathering knowledge. It's like, how can I use this education to make the space around me better? And, you know, I look to bring that into the work that we do with Literacy Mid-South as well.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you've helped me with the presentation you did at Calvary a few weeks ago is realize that there are so many barriers to literacy in our region, particularly for children and adults in minority communities. A lot of the materials that are given out by schools and other nonprofits, perhaps well-meaning, are resources that minority children just can't relate to. Tell us about right. that.
So I want to start there, but I also want to pull it back a little sure. bit, because when we talk about, you know, barriers, it is not uncommon for us to use language like deserts mm-hmm. when we talk right. about a space.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about, say, food deserts, we understand, like, there's no grocery store. Mm-hmm. Maybe there is no access to fresh food. Mm-hmm. You know, so we call that a food desert, you know, in most urban spaces. And then there's also talk about, you know, banking deserts, mm-hmm. where there are no reputable financial service organizations in a region. Mm-hmm. One thing that we're starting to see here is that there are also literacy deserts. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times those things are layered. So where you have a food desert, where you have a banking desert, you're likely to have a literacy desert as well. And so these are the things that exist in a space and create these barriers for Black and brown and minority communities. And because of, you know, all these things kind of having this, going back to the financial part of it, because there's this lack of financial transactions that are beneficial, you know, it impacts your ability to earn, impacts your ability to save, it impacts your ability to move into a better space. And so sometimes you live where you live and you just have to, you know, face the consequences of where you live. So when I think about barriers, a lot of these things are pre-existing. And again, it goes back to, you know, how this can become a multi-generational issue of poverty and racism kind of working, you know, in mm-hmm. concert with each other. And so that often, again, to your point, that comes back to even the materials that may or may not be available in a community. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about those materials in a community first before we get into sure. what happens in an education, public education space. One thing we want to do is create literacy-rich environments in where these spaces may be a desert. And so this is an actual saturation of literacy in these spaces, because, again, we're thinking, how can we be creative and, you know, do book distributions, do book giveaways? How can we, you know, do things like, you know, do lending libraries in children's waiting spaces? Because we understand that these spaces are not as literacy rich as they could be, because they're not as food rich as they could be. They're not mm-hmm. as financially rich as they could be. So this is how we kind of look to move into these spaces, you know, by understanding who are the community partners in that space, who are the residents in that space, where are the community resources that we can just lend our efforts to help to expand that. But going back to what material looks like in a public education space, from that presentation I shared, you know, it showed that in, you know, this is information from 2018, University of Wisconsin-Madison said that of all of the children's books that were published in 2018, 50% of them featured a primary character or protagonist who was a white person. And not only did it show them as the primary character, it showed them in this very positive way. It showed them as, you know, an astronaut or a race car driver or a fireman or a superhero or, you know, super athlete or something of the sort. All of these positive representations of white children in the text. And then if I remember that, so that was 50% for white children. And then I think the next number was 27%, and it featured animals again in positive representation as athletes and race car drivers and astronauts mm-hmm. and all these firemen, all these things, you know, in this positive way. But then when you look at the representation of African-American children, Latinx children, Asian Pacific Islander and, you know, indigenous people, First Nation children, collectively, they were 23%. Mm-hmm. So that collective 23% of ethnic minority children was less than the 27% of the animals mm-hmm. that you would like to see in the text. Right. And not only that, all those children were represented in less than positive ways. Mm-hmm. So you would read a story about, you know, an African-American child, you know, probably growing up in the Jim Crow South. Mm-hmm. You read a story about a First Nation child, maybe, you know, on a reservation and not having just the most affluent opportunities afforded mm-hmm. to them. And so the thing is, when we talk about education achievement, those things are measured from the state level. They're measured according to race, according to gender, and I think according to like social class, like, you know, whether they're in poverty or affluent or anything of the sort. When we look at white children, they typically perform better on statewide assessments. And it can be directly attributed to the way that they see themselves in the literature, the way they see themselves in the in the curriculum. Mm-hmm. So when you see yourself in the curriculum and you are succeeding and you are doing well and you are an astronaut and it creates this sense of belonging. It creates this level of positive self-esteem mm-hmm. where you are motivated to respond to it in a right. positive way. Whereas again, if my children see something like that, they may not have that frame of reference of, you know, like, I know astronauts exist, but mm-hmm. why aren't the astronauts black? Mm-hmm. And there's not the same level of engagement. Mm-hmm. That sense of belonging is decreased. And, you know, it may have an impact on self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And so that's one way that, you know, where we work is, you know, we are cognizant of the communities in which we work. Mm-hmm. So when we do book distributions, we understand that if we're going to do work, just say, you know, we're doing a lot of work in Raleigh. We understand that Raleigh, the Raleigh area, has a population of probably greater than 95% African American. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that we distribute books and those books are representative of positive experiences mm-hmm. That are uplifting, again, that create that sense of belonging, that instill that positive self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm a firm believer that teachers know how to teach and that education knows how to do its job. But you can be the best person at a job. You can be the most experienced person at a job. But if your tools are not the tools that are, you know, beneficial to you, your job could turn out poor. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing that we think about. We want to make sure that we're providing resources to experts who know how to do their job. We just want to make sure those tools are doing their intended function and they are the best tools possible.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of the tools, we're so excited the Church Home Board of the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee, Bishop Phoebe Rove, recently announced a $145,000 grant to help provide some of the tools, especially computer software, some new computer software and other resources that are out there. And you hired a coordinator to help work with this project, really targeting communities like Raleigh and others that have very vulnerable communities in really improving childhood literacy levels. Tell us about this partnership and how what the grant will fund and how what's your vision for it, how will all this unfold?
So I want to share that when we talk about the vision of this, we understand that we're still in a pandemic mm-hmm. and so that brought on this this increase in virtual learning opportunities, and that's where this comes into place. If we're going to have a virtual opportunity that we're going to place in front of children, how can we make sure that it's fully beneficial? But not even it's fully beneficial to the children, how does it also incorporate activity from the parent, mm-hmm. right? So this is a literacy tool, but we like to think of it as a whole family literacy engagement opportunity. Mm-hmm. So it through a company called Learning Ovations, mm-hmm. We're doing reading checkup, and I think we have. Oh, right now we're starting off with close to 2,000 software licenses that we're sharing beginning in the Raleigh community. So one, also shout out to Tory Bates at For the Kingdom and just their phenomenal mm-hmm. work that they do right there in Raleigh. They are a major partner in a lot of the things that we do. So what we're doing with this software, with this opportunity, is this is an intervention-based software that is adaptive. And adaptive is the key word. There are tons of software, from a comparison standpoint, where they start at a certain level where the child is like reading or comprehending, and it just increases and gets progressively a little bit more difficult mm-hmm. along the way. Mm-hmm. And what we see is when children are using this sort of software, they kind of plateau, and there gets to a point where they really can't get beyond that point, right? Mm-hmm. And even though this is geared to go from 1 to 10, mm-hmm. and children may get caught up at 4 or 5, it still keeps going 6, 7, 8, and getting to that next level, and children are not succeeding in the ways that they could. Our software with Read and Checkup is adaptive in the way that it sees how a child is progressing, and if it sees that the child is not getting to that next level, it will stay on that level for a moment, mm-hmm. continue to provide, you know, context to kind of build up to the next level. So it doesn't just leave the child behind. Mm-hmm. It gets to a space where it really does adapt and kind of measures where the child is before it moves to the next space. Again, this kind of creates this, one, it creates a feeling of, you know, accomplishment, mm-hmm. but it also creates this understanding of this is how we can accurately say where a child is. Mm-hmm. Like we can say that, you know, the assessment tool itself sees and captures this information and is able to comprehend back to the parent mm-hmm. that your child is doing this well or is performing at this level, and it can recommend that, you know, let's start at this level the next go around, because again, these software licenses are unique to the families that we give them to. So it's adaptive in that way and encourages learning in that way, but not, you know, again, comparatively where it just kind of takes off from 1 to 10, right. And you know, we kind of just stick a kid where you failed, you didn't succeed past this point, so this must be where your learning level lives. Mm-hmm. Whereas when it's adaptive, it allows exploration, it allows, you know, an assessment, it allows, you know, a further examination of where that kid is and where that kid can go.
All right, we're so excited about this and partnering with you. And we as we talked early on, we don't want this to just be a financial partnership. We want this to be a boots on the ground partnership. And so how can the Episcopal churches, other churches that and groups and individuals, our listeners, support and be involved in implementing the work of not only this partnership as well as fully supporting the work of Literacy Mid-South in general?
Sure. So So I would say our biggest volunteer effort, you know, this goes back to our adult learning program, mm-hmm. Which has been in many ways the cornerstone of the work that we do. We've been doing that since 1974. We are always looking for adult volunteers. Mm-hmm. And this is typically, you know, up to maybe a 6 to 8 week commitment, mm-hmm. Where, you know, you're paired with a learner and right. And we're identifying where that learner wants to go, mm-hmm. and then after that pairing, you know, we help that learner reach that moment. So right. And everybody's journey to where they want to go is a little bit different,
sure,
but you know, we're likely working with adults who may read at a 4th, 5th, possibly 6th grade level, mm-hmm. and helping them get to, again, that life moment that they're trying to reach.
Yeah.
So volunteers are always welcome there, and I think those opportunities are listed on our website, mm-hmm. literacymidsouth.org.
Right.
As far as, you know, doing the work with, I would say, with Learning Ovations and with Reading Checkup, you know, For the Kingdom is probably going to be ground zero for a lot of that. So, I mean, just reach out to us directly, mm-hmm. and we can find spaces, places to put people in. I think that, you know, that's going to be, we probably need volunteer help around just family outreach. We want to make sure that, again, if we have 2,000 software licenses, we want to make sure that they get to families that want them. So I think, yeah, volunteer around family outreach, you know, connecting with For the Kingdom. And making sure that we can reach out to those families in that space is a way that can help. And then we have our signature fundraiser, mm-hmm. coming up here on the June 11th. Mm-hmm. It's called Literatini, and it is a martini tasting competition. We have 10 bars, restaurants, wow. that will be competing for this year's title. we're glad to bring it back. Because, you know, of course, because of COVID, sure. The last 2 years we have not had the event. Mm-hmm. So we're happy to bring it back this year. It will be at Novel mm-hmm. Booksellers,
yeah.
over in the Laurelwood Shopping Center, over sure. Across from Oak Court Mall. Mm-hmm. Tickets are available. They're on our website. I would get the website messed up if I tried to remember it right now. But
literacymidsouth.org.
Yeah, I was trying to think of the event website. I was going to mess that up completely. But yeah, you can go to literacymidsouth.org, and I think it's on our front page, and you should be able to click on the logo and go there.
Yeah.
What's that?
I'll put it in the show notes.
Oh, okay. Cool. And Emily said she will put it in the show notes as well. So, and yeah, and so in fact, Bill Craddock at your presentation, one of our longtime parishioners, asked if at the end of the evening, after all those martinis, if you would be administering a reading test.
Nah, no, but we are being responsible, and you know we will take your keys.
Okay,
if you've had too much, yes.
If need be,
yes.
But it sounds like a fun event, a fun, great way to celebrate literacy and to help in a fun way. And finally, Sam, on this Ascension Day, tell us what people's stories and ideas are lifting you up personally.
Wow, I'll go back to my parents. Yeah. 2019 was a tough year for my parents. My dad suffered a stroke, and my mom had gone through just a couple of surgeries that just, you know, had them both down and out, you know, for a good bit of 2019. Mm-hmm. Happy to say right now that I think dad has about 90% of his function back. Mm-hmm. You know, he can't drive long distances, mm-hmm. but he can drive his lawn tractor and get his yard cut. Yeah. So he's happy about that just beyond measure. And you know, my mom, she still has, you know, follow-up appointments for the surgeries that she had back then, and she's doing extremely well. So I think about their example, because my parents, you know, I was telling you, like, even when they retired from teaching, they were semi-retired. They mm-hmm. would go back and part-time teach for a semester.
Yeah.
And they would do a lot of volunteer work with the Mississippi School for Math and Science.
Sure.
My little brother graduated
from
there.
Columbus, Mississippi, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Matter of fact, my niece, her graduation is this Saturday. And they did a lot of work there, a lot of volunteerism there. And even into their 70s, they were still, and my brother graduated years beyond then, mm-hmm. Before then rather, and they were still active with the parent group. And they were so active that the award for Parent of the Year is named after them.
Wow.
So the award is the Sam and Emily O'Brien Parent of the Year Award. And this year, you know, I said my niece is graduating there mm-hmm. this Saturday. This year, my sister-in-law won the award.
Wow.
So it's there's these full circle moments, yeah, where, you know, I think about my parents and their legacy and how they continue to pour into communities. And I think about that. You know, they're leaving some pretty big shoes to fill. Because I'm named after my dad, so,
yeah,
you know, gotta...
Got a lot to live up to.
But
I can tell they're very proud of you, and rightfully so, and proud of how you blended this education, policy, politics, yearning for you, and how it's all come together, and you're doing it in a way honoring their legacy,
yeah,
in a powerful way. And Sam, it's just been delightful. Thank you for joining us for this conversation. And we're so grateful for the diocese's new partnership with Literacy Mid-South. And we pray that it somehow lifts us all up to higher ground. The next segment is called Stump the Priest, in which we attempt to tackle a difficult question about faith. Today's question is, what is intercessory prayer, and does it make any difference at all when we pray for our own needs and those of others? One of my earliest childhood memories is hearing my parents tell me the story of how I almost died at age 3. I had contracted a severe staph infection and was in the hospital for several days. Mom and Dad told me how that during each of those days, the people of Little Monticello, Mississippi Baptist Church prayed fervently for me. They told me about the many phone calls, cards, notes, flowers, meals, and everything else they received from church members. But what struck me as a child were all those prayers. I could hear in my mind 1,000 prayers being lifted up to God for me. And in my heart and mind, I linked those 1,000 prayers to God somehow intervening and changing the direction and outcome of what happened. What my parents told me was that all indications were that I was supposed to die, yet somehow I lived. Intercessory prayer is what we do when we pray for ourselves or for others. What is interesting about the earliest intercessory prayers is how raw and personal they are. Abraham actually bargained with God. When God planned to destroy Sodom, he said, "What if we could find 50 righteous people there?" God said, "Well, okay, if we can find 50. Then Abraham said, "Well, how about 45, 40, 30, 20, how about 10? Each time God said, "Okay." And later, the entire hymn book of Psalms is a constant song of intercessory prayer with the refrain, "God, just help me and save me from the wild beast on the other side of this hill, the enemy army that is headed my way, or the deepest, darkest iniquity that lies within myself." At last, we come to Jesus, our great high priest, who intercedes for us without ceasing. In the Gospel of John, he prays this prayer for us, his friends. "Holy Father, protect them in your name that you have given me, so that they may be one as we are one." So what is happening in intercessory prayer? The harder question is, why does the outcome sometimes change in a positive way as it did for me at age 3, but sometimes it doesn't? Perhaps intercessory prayer is not all about outcomes. The Jesuit theologian Karl Rahner wrote, "Who understands intercessory prayer? Only one who prays. If you want to understand it, pray, beg, weep. Beg for the necessities of the body so that your petition for the earthly gift transforms you more and more into a heavenly being. Beg so that you make yourself into an offering from above during the petition for the gift from above. Beg so that your continuing prayer of petition appears to be a pledge of your faith in the light of God, in the darkness of the world, for your hope for life in this constant dying, for your loyalty of love that loves without reward." Intercessory prayer changes us as much as it does the person or persons for whom we are praying. As we lift up each name before God, we are somehow lifted up to God as well. We carry the messiness and murkiness of our own lives and our hope for ourselves and others in the midst of that messiness and murkiness into the life and light of God. And God listens, and God cares, and God acts. And often, especially this week, God weeps. I am blessed with a visible reminder of the relationship between prayer, action, and love. My mom told me that when I was in the hospital, the medical team made 2 incisions in my abdomen. She told me that my dad volunteered to help run a tape through the incisions that pulled out some of the infected tissue. I still hold on to that image of my father sitting over me, meticulously running a tape through those two tiny incisions. I could see each motion of him as offering a little prayer for his son. I can hear a song in my heart, much like the song of Jean Valjean in the musical Les Miserables. "God on high, hear my prayer. In my need, you have always been there. He is young. He's afraid. Let him rest. Heaven blessed. Bring him home. Bring him home. Bring him home." I still have 2 little parallel scars on my right side. When I touch them, they remind me of one father praying to another father, "Bring him home." And those 1,000 prayers of church members back then, along with our 1,000 prayers today, lift us up to the hope that along with the 22 new angels from Uvalde, Jesus, our friend, will bring us all home. Thanks to Sam O'Brien for our conversation this morning. You can find Literacy Mid-South at literacymidsouth.org. And come wear red and join us at Calvary Episcopal Church for Pentecost Sunday on June 5th when the Reverend Eileen Farmer, founder of Thistle and Bee Ministry, will return to Calvary's pulpit to preach at 8 and 10:30 a.m. with a festive outdoor parish picnic in Calvary Park to follow. And a reminder, too, that St. Mary's Episcopal Cathedral at 700 Poplar will be open today and tomorrow, Thursday and Friday, May 26th and 27th, from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. for a time of prayers and reflection following the Uvalde shooting. You can find the Episcopal Diocese of West Tennessee on Facebook, Instagram, and at edwtn.org.